History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we ought to hear. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Fresno, California with a couple who just celebrated their 79th wedding anniversary. I know it sounds impossible, but we're going to hear the story. We'll start with the older of the two, Lewis Wagoner, 96 years old, of Fresno, California. But you grew up in a place that's become a little more famous the last few years, thanks to Hollywood. McFarland, California. McFarland, USA, a great film talking about their cross-country team. But that was a few decades after you came through that high school. What was it like growing up there in rural Kern County way back when?
Well, it was just, it was back the way it really should have been. I mean, we walked to school. Well, before, earlier we did the school bus, but then we finally moved to town. McFarland to town. I walked to grammar school, walked to high school, come home for lunch. You know, you had a lot of freedom. Back in those days, we didn't lock our doors or anything like that, so that's about the way it was.
Well, and you had a big family, a blended family. You had a few half-siblings and then eight siblings with the same parents. And I'm just imagining a big family like that in the Great Depression must have been fairly memorable. What do you remember about those years?
A lot of everybody had their chores. And of course, I was, as the oldest, my half-siblings were gone by that time. And so I milked the cow twice a day. And we had chickens and rabbits in the backyard, so we had something to eat. And things were tough. We made it all right.
You know, other than milking the cow in the morning and the evening, what kinds of things did you pass the time with back then? What did kids in the 1930s do for fun?
Well, we did all sorts of things. Climbed trees, hiked, went frogging with bow and arrow, and did the chores and kept busy with something.
Do you remember, I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember having some of those ideas that boys sometimes have? Hey, when I grow up, here are the things that I'm going to do with my life?
I had no idea. Absolutely not. In fact, I just stumbled on to getting where I finally made it in life. But from going to school in McFarland, I mean, I was a cotton picker before they made mechanical Okies. And I picked grapes, and, you know, we did that to help with the school clothes and something to eat. We made it. We made it through.
Well, and from what ages? How old do you think you were when you were out there picking cotton or grapes to help cover the family budget?
We started when I was about five. Mom and Dad had the regular cotton sacks, and I got a gunny sack with a deal, and I'd pick the cotton and put it on top of theirs, and they'd go weigh it. So we worked in the fields and whatever I could do.
Good thing it doesn't get hot in a Kern County summer, right?
Oh, no. It never gets hot. I mean, out there cutting grapes in September when it's 110 and and fighting the wasps. So, yeah, that was the first one that came off. We would put the raisins down and fight the wasps, and then later on we'd pick the cotton. Whatever odd jobs we could do. And it wasn't easy. We didn't have a lot of money.
You say we didn't have a lot of money. Did that affect your degree of happiness or joy or fulfillment?
It just seemed like it was what we had to do.
And did you ever have any thoughts as that kid out there picking cotton and grapes and doing all those things? Do you have any thoughts of getting on a sailboat and racing?
Never a thought. I mean, sailboats or something like that were just funny. But most of the kids played baseball, and I didn't like baseball. So many times I'd sit out in left field for the whole game and never touch the ball. You know, that's no fun for me. I like something active. So I did more active things. The McFarland High School football team, student money was 150. And I was on the football team, third string. So I was really good.
Well, they just didn't have the sport that you would eventually excel at and win national championships in sailing, but we'll hear about that. Normally, when I'm talking to World War II veterans, one of the first things I want to ask them about is about December 7th, 1941, and how they experienced that day, but there was a pretty significant day in your life that came a year and a half before that. In February of 1940, you got married. You were only 17 years old. And your bride was only 15. So I've got to hear the story of how you and Ruth met. What's that story?
Well, I was living there in McFarland on summer vacation. Not much to do, not much work. So I went down to San Bernardino, or Highland, actually, to visit some cousins. And he says, oh, I got to take you over and show you this cute gal, you know. Well, then he wished he hadn't. So anyway, it finally ended up that we got married there on February 22nd, 1940, and we've been at it ever since.
Yeah, 79 years and counting now. You're on your 80th year of marriage. But what possessed you at the time? 17 years old, you're in high school still, to quit high school, run away, and get married. And what did your parents have to say about it?
Well, they thought it was not too smart, but here we are. So that's the saga.
Well, I think we'll come back before we're done, and I'll give you some time to think about it. But I'm assuming after 79 years of marriage, you've learned a few things that you can share with the rest of us who aspire to that kind of longevity. So you're married now. What did you do to pay the bills and support this bride of yours?
Well, like I say, I did agricultural work, and one of the things I did, I drove a tractor pulling a harvester, just whatever we could get. Later on, because I knew how to milk cows, I worked in dairies down in San Bernardino, and finally I got burned out on that. The wars had started, so I went to the Navy Yard in Bear Island and told them I wanted a job. And they said, oh, what kind of a job you want? I said, anything. What do you got? So I spent almost the whole day in the personnel deal taking physicals and written exams. And it was my first experience with an aptitude test. And so about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they says, okay, you're a helper ship fitter. Show up at shop 11 at midnight tonight and go to work. And I said, what the heck is a ship fitter? But it was right down my alley.
So what the heck is a ship fitter? A lot of people today would have no idea.
Well, we lay out and fabricate steel structures, for it be built a lot of engine foundations for submarines. They were improving their engines, getting better, some deck houses. And after I became a ship fitter, I was a helper to start with. The Nassau, which was blown apart out in the Coral Sea, had a hole right through the, I don't know how, the bomb didn't explode inside the ship, but it went through both sides. So, and it didn't sink, so they closed off all the doors. So the hull strength job for that was what I'm doing on my graveyard shift. I did that, and that turned out real good. So I got an advancement and just all sorts of things. But layout and fabrication of steel is what it is. I like working with steel.
Well, you know what? Let me come back to all that, because I'm thinking I should probably get her side of the getting married story as well before I forget to come to her. So, Ruth, he told me that, you know, his cousin said, you got to come over and see this cute girl. What do you remember about this guy from McFarland who showed out there?
Well, that was his cousin. I remember he was a nice guy, and I think he kind of liked me, but Lewis interfered, and I fell in love with him, and that's the story.
15 years old.
Yep.
And he asked you to marry him?
Yes. Would you marry me? I think is what he said.
Did that sound like a crazy idea to you?
No, I didn't like school.
So what did your parents say?
They said, okay, but you're too young. But they agreed.
So where'd you have to go to get married?
Las Vegas.
You think that wedding chapel's still there?
I don't know, but I doubt it. That's a long time ago.
Was that a little scary or unknown to dive off into that kind of adventure together at such a young age?
No, my girlfriends got married about the same time as I did. Yeah, then we got married young, but not now.
Well, I'm guessing their marriages couldn't have lasted 79 years, right?
No, there's none of them alive. They're all gone.
Is it hard for you to believe it's been this long?
Yes, it's hard, and we have had a good life together. Our sailing was a highlight of our life, plus our three children. They are good children.
Do you remember your first impression of this guy?
I can kind of vaguely remember. He was very young, both were, but very handsome, and fell in love with him right away.
What about Pearl Harbor Day? Because here you're, like you said, you're working, you're trying to support a young wife. How'd you find out about what happened out there?
We were at a theater there, and it was a Sunday, so I got one day off from milking the cows, and we went to the theater, and they stopped the show and says Pearl Harbor's been bombed and shook everybody up. I don't know how to explain it any better.
And that was out in San Bernardino or where?
Yeah.
So you've got a child already, and now, you know, there's a wife and a child to take care of. Was there a thought in your mind that now that America's at war, you might become part of it?
Well, yeah. I mean, we, back in those days, you were patriotic, and we tried to enlist, but they wouldn't take family men at that time. Yeah, we were, our country's at war. We're going to fight.
So right after Pearl Harbor, you went and tried to sign up?
Yeah, the next day, right away anyway. But they weren't taking family men, so did what we had to do. Then I went to work at the Navy Yard, and at 1944, I guess, they got to the point where they were taking married men and got my draft notice and went to that part.
So up until that point, from 42 to 44, you're working there at Mare Island as a ship fitter, as you talked about. You told us about repairing the Nassau after it had been hit in action. Can you help us understand what the atmosphere was like back then as far as being in a war-related industry, being on the West Coast in a seaport that could be a target, and hearing the constant news of what was going on around the world?
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody was patriotic back in those days, not like today. Yeah, we all worked together, and that's how we were able to win the war. Yeah, we didn't have the attitude that's prevalent a lot today.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because so often we hear about, you know, the 16 million Americans in uniform, and you would become one of them. But at this point, for a couple years, you're not in uniform, but you're doing something that's vital to the war effort. And so many other wars. Women were, older men who weren't young enough to serve, they were doing the same thing. Did you feel like you were doing something important, something that was helping?
I felt I was adding to it, and I did. And, you know, in retrospect, I was doing more for the war effort as a ship fitter and repairing the ships and doing whatever we were doing. But then my number came up, and so then I became an aviation radioman and operation in PBYs, and then the war was over, so I didn't see the war zones.
Well, we'll talk about that. What else about your time at Mare Island? What else did you see there or experience there that stands out in your memory?
Yeah, they do their best to camouflage. Back in those days, they did the best to camouflage the facility. Then they'd put these balloons up to show you where they were.
A little bit of a contradiction?
Yeah, it's a little contradiction. The object was the cables from those balloons, would, if anybody, you know, the dive bomber or something would come in, they'd run into the cables and come out. But why go to the trouble of camouflaging and then put the barrage balloons up to show you where it was?
X marks the spot, yeah. And Mare Island was a pretty busy place then. And you can go there now. They have a museum there, and they still have that famous chapel with the Tiffany windows and all that in the East Bay. But back then, there was a whole lot of activity there.
We were real, real busy. Three shifts, and it was the first time I'd ever worked an eight-hour day. So as a ship fitter, I had a progress report on all the projects I was working on, and I'd have to write each where each one was, and so the next shifts were good. And they kept it up so we could keep everything moving slowly. So.
And I think, you know, those of us who didn't live through World War II, I think we have a hard time understanding how ever-present that situation was. When you would, you know, see the newspaper headline or hear something on the radio about a battle in the Pacific or in Europe or wherever, was there a concern that America and its allies might not win this war?
Well, no, we had every faith that we were going to win. We didn't have a defeatist attitude. We're going to win, so we finally did. Man, it was because of the attitude of everybody. I mean, you wanted to contribute to the war effort. Even those who wanted to draft, dodge the draft, they were working in the war effort. Even they were putting out the product to finally enable our guys to win.
Win they would. Time for our first break, but much more to come with 96-year-old Lewis Wagoner. If you live in California, you've likely benefited from some of his engineering expertise, and you didn't even realize it. And we're also hear how an ill-fated camping trip led to a prolific career in sailboat racing. Hear that part of the story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with Lewis and Ruth Wagoner on their 80th year of marriage in Fresno, California. They got married when he was 17 and she was 15. Less than 2 years later, the attack on Pearl Harbor drew America into World War II. Shortly after that, Lewis went to work at Mare Island Naval Shipyard as a ship fitter, but eventually he would be drafted into the Navy.
First off, this being married, they wanted the single guys. And then later on, it's okay, marriage's okay, but one or two, but with three kids, no, it added to the allotment, which was not much for them to get by on. But
so you're saying that the policy of not drafting guys with three kids wasn't so much about sympathy for the family, but the bottom line of the government having to pay for the kids.
Extra money.
But eventually they got to that point. And I guess my question for you is, did you know that? Were you surprised when you were finally drafted?
No, not really, because they were picking up the guys out of the Navy Yard quite often. And it was no big surprise.
And how'd you feel about it?
I'm going to fight now. That was the attitude back in those days.
How much did it weigh on you, though, that if you were going to go overseas and fight, that there was a wife and three kids that you'd be leaving behind?
Well, that was there, but, I mean, somebody had to go fight. So that was the attitude of most of us.
So you ended up in the Navy. Was that your idea to get into naval aviation, or how did that come about?
Well, you go down to the boot camp and go through all this stuff, and they tell you all this stuff. Well, I like boats and I like flying. I didn't have any idea I'd end up, that'd be an aviation radio, but I figured I'd probably end up in a two-seat bomber or fighter. But it ended up in the PBYs. They were finally, at that time, they used primarily for air sea rescue. And the Japs didn't pay too much attention to the PBYs because I heard that probably the high command in Tokyo says, leave those PBYs alone because we could get right down on the water. So if they took off after you, if you didn't shoot them down, you just get right above the water. And we have to do to intercept, they would always crash into the water. So we studied that to see how, you know, whatever, they've got a plane coming in, you know, how much to lead and all that kind of stuff. So that's, they didn't bother the PBYs that much, and particularly in the late stages.
And your training in the PBY, and you mentioned radio man and gunner, and we've had a few guys from those PBY Catalinas on the show before, and they've had some good stories about it. But for folks who aren't familiar with these flying boats, how many people on the crew, and what were the things you were responsible for?
We carried two of everybody. So there were two harnessmen, two radiomen, two AMMs, mechs. They started the engines, and two pilots, and sometimes a navigator. Most of the time we did. I took when I was on watch, I had to take the radio direction, find our bearings and all that so that we'd know where the hell we were. And So that has been a valuable part because I could use that when I was racing ocean races. I always knew where I was out there. So some of the other guys followed the beer cans.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to ask you how any of this played into your future exploits in sailing. And you mentioned that by that point in the war, later on in World War II, that the primary role of these PBYs was air and sea rescue. Did you guys get to participate in any of that?
No, I was just about ready, except there was no air-sea rescue at ADAC after October. The wars were over. So I did my job. The wars were over, so I had to go back and find a new career. Why feed the family.
Do you remember what it was like when you heard the war ended? What kind of reaction there was?
It was a real celebration. Of course, we went into Europe first, and then we could put more pressure on the Pacific. And that Battle of the Coral Sea was just about the turning point. Some of the ships got beat up pretty bad out there. This one was a supply ship. They needed the supplies, and it was a big deal to get it in and out of. They patched it up in Pearl Harbor and sent it to Mariana to be finished. Didn't want it to sink on the way.
Yeah. Well, and that's there's a significant example of the impact that you and those other guys at Mare Island had on getting ships like that sea ready again. I guess I should ask you, how many stories like that there are? How many ships did you guys repair?
Oh, we repaired any number of them. I mean, we get the work order and go to work on them, and I don't remember, but worked on a lot of submarines, and we were building a sub tender there, which was a giant machine shop. And it's about it. But we felt good when we saw the submarines coming back, flying a broom. That means they had a clean sweep.
Well, and there were a lot of those subs, too, that didn't come back, 52 of them in World War II that were lost. And I guess that makes me wonder, too, when you're working on some of these ships or a boat like that and you see some damage, does it compute that there's a human element of that, too, that if the ship is in that kind of shape, that maybe some people were injured or killed?
Oh, yeah. Well, if they were needing physical repairs, I mean, yeah, they had that. But I made a whole bunch of sets of engine foundations for new engines, and, of course, that's just getting them in better shape to do their job.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One, if you can think back to a couple of years of doing that, was there one project or challenge or repair task you had to approach that you recall as kind of the most challenging or stressful?
Well, that Nassau was the one. What we had is priority for the different machines, you know, whatever we were doing with those welders or with the straighteners or with the machine shop or wherever. So that was a priority of 100, meant when you take it there, that's the first job that they do, and let the ones with a lower priority out. Well, when you get it with 1,000, and that's what this Nassau is. It's a 1,000 priority.
That gets the point across. Well, and when I ask you about, you know, being aware of the casualties and knowing that subs are lost, that ships are lost. I mean, you mentioned the Coral Sea battle. They just found a few months ago the Lexington, which was sunk then and is at the bottom of the sea. Were there people you knew, whether from growing up or school or working together at the shipyard or even in the Navy together, were there guys you knew that didn't come home?
I don't think so. I think if they did, we didn't know about it. Our job was to get them ready to go again.
Well, one of the reasons I asked is because I know that coming up in the very near future, you're going to make a trip with Honor Flight Kern County out of Bakersfield to Washington, D.C., to see that World War II memorial, which honors the 406,000 Americans who never came home from the war. What are you looking forward to about that journey?
It's something that the ones who've been there said it's awe-inspiring, and it's something that you should see. So I'm going.
Well, I know you're going to have a wonderful time. That's a great organization, and they do a tremendous job. You know, I want to come back over to Ruth for a second here because I'm thinking about this point where he's been working in the shipyards, and you're at home raising three kids, and Uncle Sam says, hey, we need to borrow your husband for a while, and we can't guarantee that he's going to come back. What was that like as a young mother with three little kids to have your husband going off to the Navy?
Well, it wasn't easy. I had to move in with my mother. She took care of the children while I worked. And at that time, I didn't have a driver's license, so I had to catch a bus at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work. And it wasn't easy, but we made it.
And what about the fear factor? Was there that concern of, hey, is he going to come back? And what's going to happen to him?
Well, I thought about it occasionally when I had time to think about it with three kids and trying to live with mother and all. It wasn't easy, but we did.
And he's talked about this this spirit of patriotism that existed then, this this unity in the country, unity of purpose, all people working together. How did you see that play out at that time?
The same. I felt that he needed to help, but I also felt he needed to be home with me. But that was more important, and he went, and I lived with my mother, and she helped me by taking care of the children so I could work. And, of course, I lived with her. She did all the cooking and everything, but we did it.
Did your kids ever ask, where's Daddy or when's Daddy coming home?
My son, every time he saw a sailor, he'd run and grab his leg and say, Daddy, Daddy. No, they were pretty young. The oldest was 5, and she says, Dad's gone, Dad's gone, and that was all.
Well, let me come back to you, Lewis. That makes me wonder what it was like for you. And again, you ended up not having to go overseas. You were ready to, but the war ended. But you had been gone for a while, in uniform for a while, training for all this for a while. What was that like to come back and see your wife and see those three little kids again?
Well, it was great. I mean, you know, that's why I was thankful to get an early discharge instead of going to ADAC for the winter. I was only in about a year and a half. So since the wars were over, I could see no reason to stay as long as I could get out. So I was home on that 36 days delayed orders, and I heard on the radio one time that fathers of three kids could get out early discharge. And I listened and never heard it. So I got up to Whidbey Island, and they were calling for High Point men, and I said, well, you know, I don't have very many points, but I heard that fathers of three kids could get early discharge. He says, you got three kids? I said, yeah. Well, how'd you get out of Jacksonville? So I went before it came out. Uh-huh. And so then I had to, but the Navy, you got to muster in all the way through. Then you got to turn around and muster back out for the day. I was guaranteed a 6 months employment at the shipyard, but shipbuilding is a wartime job. The wars are over. I got to find something different. And so it took me a little while, and then I answered a newspaper ad for engineering assistant. That's a job. So they hired me, and I was with the Division of I 38 years. I went to work at a 1946, August 12th of 1946, for the state of California for $150 a month. Uh-huh. One payday a month.
That's how you learn to make it last, huh? So that the California Division of Highways, we know it now as Caltrans, and there are a few more highways now than there were in 1946. But I imagine that a lot of the people listening, because we're on radio stations up and down the state of California, they've all been on highways or bridges or exits and on-ramps and off-ramps that you probably had a role in. What kind of work were you doing?
I started out rear chainman and a brush cutter and worked my way up to... Finally, I was a project design engineer and designing the highways. And then as a traffic engineer, the last 10 years, I'd made safety corrections so that for an unusual situation on a highway and there was an accident record, do something about it. You go investigate and see what the problem is and then calculate out a priority position and put it on the program.
We'll hear about a couple of his favorite projects when we come back, and how did he become a North American champion in his sailboat, teaming up with his wife to set a winning course time after time. Hear the rest of that story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next.
The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes in an episode that's been a little different today. So often we hear from people who spent World War II in the thick of combat, on the ground, at sea, or in the air. Today we've picked up a little different perspective, but one that I think is just as important and powerful. Like their entire generation, Lewis and Ruth Wagoner had their lives interrupted by the all-consuming, all-hands-on-deck urgency of World War II. They couldn't have imagined their 80th year of marriage that they're working on now, because their future, the future of their three children, and the future of our country were all uncertain. Lou tried to enlist after the attack on Pearl Harbor, but was passed over because he was married and had a young child at home. His first contribution to the war effort came at Mare Island Naval Shipyard in California's Bay Area, which by the end of the war would produce 17 submarines, 31 destroyer escorts, and over 300 landing craft, in addition to repairing ships damaged in the war. By 1944, however, the needs of the growing worldwide effort brought a draft notice to his home, and Lou had to leave Ruth and their three children as he trained to become an aviation radio man and gunner on PBY Catalina flying boats. Japan surrendered before he had to go overseas, and like many of the veterans we meet here on Hometown Heroes, his life after World War II is pretty interesting too. One of the reasons Tom Brokaw famously labeled these Americans as our greatest generation was that after banding together to preserve freedom, they went to work and in many ways built the communities we call home today. For the Wagoners, competitive sailing would eventually yield some significant accomplishments. But Lou's vocation after the war is something many of us who live in California have benefited from without even knowing it. He spent 38 years with the Department of Highways, in some cases designing stretches of road and in others trying to figure out how to fix areas that had proven unsafe.
We had a lot of highways with compound curves. Cars would be driving down the highway. There's a sign that says 35 miles an hour. And you get on this first part of the compound curve, they say, what the hell are they talking about, 35 miles an hour? And then you hit, and already you've accelerated and hit it too fast. So that's one of the, I did a lot of corrections, taking out the compound curves, taking out curves that were too tight, realigning a section of the highway, or adding a guardrail or a median barrier. I was putting in lots and lots of median barrier. They did the job of taking out the oleanders and putting in the median barrier, because, oh, you're taking out those beautiful oleanders. Well, when you get to the point where it was having a lot of cross-median accidents, and a lot of times the guys were going the right speed, they'd hit those, and that instead of crashing into them and slowing them down, they over the top, and so they hit the traffic in the opposing lane or just about windshield high. So they were hazardous under those conditions because they would jump the, yeah.
You mentioned time designing highways too. Is there a particular stretch of road that you're proud of having a role in, or that every time you pass by now, you say, hey, I remember when I worked on that?
Well, yeah, one that I'm pretty happy with was I did the design on 152 from 99 to the Merced County line. I was restricted in what I was allowed to do I didn't get to design it the way I really wanted to, but the structural section of the highway, so the westbound lanes, the new lanes that we put in, we designed the highway with a surface, a 20-year life for the surface. So you compare asphalt or concrete, whichever goes well, I could justify concrete pavement, and I put those in the 1960s, and it's still about the only concrete pavement that you drive on that doesn't go click, 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 click. It's still smooth. But I had better basement soil to start the structural section than most people had in subgrade. The design, I was restricted by second line supervisor. You can't do that, Wagoner. So anyway, then the bottom end of the four lane on 168 from the Lodge Road to the big curve, I did that. Corps of Engineers did the upper part.
Well, and I've got to ask, I'm curious, you talk about the stretch of Highway 152, and this is in Central California, if people were ever traveling between Madera through Chowchilla to Red Top. I'm from Las Banas, so that would be right on my way to my hometown. What would have been different had you been able to do it the way you wanted to?
I could have increased the median width between the two. We started the design when the standard for that median width was pretty restrictive. Well, I could have expanded that because we're dealing with the property owners. If you buy an inch wide or 200 feet wide, you're going to pay the same price. So I could have done that, and there was a couple of the ramps or overcrossings that this guy forced me to put the intersection at the worst possible place on the overcrossing, worst possible sight distance. And the sad thing is, the way I had it would have been cheaper.
Cheaper and safer, probably.
Oh, yeah, cheaper and safer, because this particular one I'm thinking about, they've already paid $150,000 for two suits, and it would have been cheaper to do it right to start with, but that's what I was facing.
And the other project you mentioned, when you said the four lane of Highway 168, this is if people were heading up from Fresno or anywhere in the Central Valley to Shaver Lake or Huntington Lake, where you have a lot of sailing experience, they're going to cross over this stretch of road you designed?
Corps of Engineers, like I said, built the major part of it, but I just did that bottom from about the middle of the big curve back to Lodge Road. So I got a couple of things there. You're going to have a T intersection, and the dry creek was right on the other side. So I says, well, we need to put the culverts in there because anybody coming down there is going to run over that, end up in the creek. So that's a big park and ride lot now.
I know exactly what you're talking about there. Well, and you, I'm sure, have lost count of the number of times you've traversed that section of road going up to Huntington Lake for the High Sierra Regatta. I've got to hear the story, how you ended up catching this sailing bug. Where did that come from?
Well, we were, like I say, we didn't have a lot of money, so about what we could do with the family was go camping on the weekends and go trout fishing. We would camp and take off up to creek with a fly rod and do that. One of the, I think in 58, camped up there at one spot and hiked back to the Ursham Lake. It started raining just as we got outside of camp a little ways. Rained all the way up there, rained all the way back. Everything was wet. She says, let's go home. So we took everything wet, put it in the car, and came back. So the next year she rented a cabin in Huntington. And so if you go up here to Middleton, watch the sailboats out there. Instead up on the dam, you used to be able to park up on the dam and watch the races or whatever's going on out there. And you see these sailboats going all which direction. You had no idea, you know. So in 1959, then after that wet deal and all that, she rented a cabin at Huntington Lake. And there it's a long, narrow lake, and they come in close and say, you get to watch it. They look like they're having fun. So I investigated, and by golly, they were. So that was how we got interested in it.
So the guy who's been telling me he didn't have a lot of money would become the president of the Fresno Yacht Club and race up there at Huntington and all over the country for many, many years. And I don't know if we have time to tell me every race you won, but what were some of the highlights of your competitive sailing career, and who's the best crewmate you ever had?
Well, when the day sailor was my wife, she was the crew. She was good at it. and some of the other boats. Well, the last race, Newport to Ensenada race, last time I had to go, I won in class, so that was 125-mile ocean race. Then I won a lot of challenge races, and first time they had a Pacific Coast Championship, I won that. I think I won that about five times, and I got two and almost another one of the North American Championship, because we included Canada. So we had a U.S. and Canada, and we won it twice.
And when you say we, you're talking about you and your wife. So for people who are novices in the sailing world, walk me through this. What kind of a vessel is this? How big is it? And what do you have to do? How well do you have to work together to get a trophy?
The boat was a 17-foot fiberglass O'Day day sailor. It had a nice cuddy cabin and good bait seats, and all that. Was a comfortable boat to sail. So what you got to do to win is, well, first I think you have to have fun. We were having fun. That's why we got the boat. And you have to have your equipment in good shape, good sails, and you got to pay attention. I've taught lots of sailing classes, and they say, well, what's the most important? Pay attention. Because the least little, this is what I used to have a lot of fun with, racing the guys at the ocean. We'd go down and race the midwinters and stuff. They would miss those little 5-degree wind shifts. I would take them, and I won most of the time.
So what you're saying is you're picking up on details that just escaped other competitors.
I hope I was.
Uh-huh. And what about working with your partner in crime over here? I imagine that takes good communication.
She could anticipate what I was going to do, so it worked real good.
So you didn't even have to shout out those captain's commands? She was a step ahead of you?
No, I could punch her a couple of times, and easy punch. just say, do this. She knew what I was going to do, so, and that's important. And then our tacks were smooth, but it's got to be fun. I sailed as good as I could in every race, but if I didn't win, you had fun. You got to sail. But nobody loses a sailboat race.
I don't know if you have an answer for this or not. How many races you think you've been in?
I had a bunch of trophies that I got rid of, and I had no idea I had that many. One of the great-grandsons counted them. I think it was almost 300 that was on display, and then I had a bunch of them I'd taken the plaques off and put in shoebox and put them up in the attic and the garage and everywhere. When I started digging them out, how come I get... So we had all sorts of... Yeah, I had a lot of trophies.
Well, I imagine in that mix, there had to be some fairly close races, right?
Oh, yeah. The first time I won the championship in Georgia, there was nobody close enough to us after five races. They run six races for one throwout. So I calculated out, and so I didn't have to race the last race. Drove all the way back while they were racing the last race. Went to Atlanta, 40 miles, across two counties, to get Champaign to celebrate our win. The second time I won in Arlington, Texas, I didn't have that cushion, but I still won. And like I say, in Lake Cowan, Ohio, I missed it by 1/4 of a point.
Something just tells me, too, if you have that many races, there had to be some where things didn't quite go right. Do you ever sit around and chuckle about some of the mishaps you encountered?
Oh, yeah. The first time I realized that it was an important, it was a High Sierra regatta, an important regatta. And in the last minute, you're running the line and picking out your point so you can hit the line right when the gun goes off. And the crystal came off my stopwatch. I had to make a maneuver. I dropped the thing, and the hand came back. So I had no idea what the time was. So I fouled, and I'm sailing back to the dock, and I says, I've just fouled out an important race, and it doesn't bother me. As luck would have it, I got back to the dock, and there was two other classes that almost the same as the guys who were top-notchers, always win, were doing the same thing I was doing. But that's the first time I realized, and I never did get, you know, most of the time the guys get butterflies, they can't eat breakfast, they're nervous at the stop. But the start is the most important. If you can get off the start line clean and then get out in the race. So that's what I did. So when I screwed up, it didn't bother me, I still had fun.
Maybe that's part of it, but I'm just wondering, after all these decades in sailing, are there some important lessons you look at and say, you know, I learned that because of my time out there on the water?
Well, I can't think of any. I just learned to pay attention. That's it. First off, you have to have your hull. That's got to be slick. Your sails have got to be good. Your rigging has got to be easy to use without too much effort. You have to have a gentle touch to the tiller. It just got to come kind of natural.
Well, let me throw this one at you. Again, 79 years of marriage far outpaces, I'm pretty sure, just about everybody listening. I doubt there's anyone listening who's been married longer than 79 years. Do you think that all that time the two of you spent together, having to work together in these races, you think that helped your marriage?
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. Yeah. We did real well. I mean, it was really kind of the highlight. We were doing something together, so I don't play golf. Never had time. We go sailing. So we were doing things with the family. We were doing things with the boat. Well, my son raced a little bit. In fact, a couple of races he beat me. But not normally, not usually.
When do they do that High Sierra Regatta?
July. It's traditionally been second and third full weekends in July. One for the centerboards, one for the keelboats. I haven't sailed it in 3 years or maybe 4 years. I don't know. And they've changed their formats and stuff like that.
Well, and people who are listening say, did he just say 4 years? Because they're saying that means he was in his 90s the last time he sailed in this High Sierra Regatta. Do you ever wake up some days and say, man, I'd like to get back out on that boat right now?
I can still do it. Oh, it's no, I have no problems. I'm only 96, but I have no problems.
So if someone calls you up between now and July and says, hey, can I be part of your crew for the High Sierra Regatta? You're up for it?
Well, I'll probably be selling the boat before then, but yeah, I could sail the boat. Sailing is, to me, not a solo sport. They've got those single-handers out there. The guys go out and single-hand, but it's a social sport. So, and like having the big boat, 25 feet is a big boat. We had two couples, you know, a son. We'd have another couple as a crew, so we'd have four. So it was a social thing as well as racing, and we did pretty well.
And I mentioned, you know, half kiddingly, the idea of the Fresno Yacht Club. What's the funniest thing you've ever heard when you show up saying, hey, I'm with the Fresno Yacht Club?
Most of the places, they knew who I was by then, but one of the things, when you're buying the Coronado 25, you go take a demonstration ride or whatever with the guy, where are you from? I was from Fresno. There's no water in Fresno. But we've gotten more sailing from Fresno than would have gotten, say, in San Diego or somewhere else, because we can go to the mountains, we can go to the coast, we can go to regattas north, south. So we've gotten actually more sailing in from Fresno than some people that live right on the water. We enjoyed it all. Like I say, we sailed as good as we could, and if we won, that was great. If we didn't, we still had fun.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Is there something you look back on, 96 years old now, and you say, yeah, that's what I'm most proud of?
Well, not really. I mean, I just do the best I can and everything I do, and, well, I'm kind of proud we made it 79 years.
And counting. You're on year number 80. So how'd you do that? Because I'm sure you get to ask that a lot. People want to know. You have no idea. You got to have some idea. What's the secret? What's your advice?
Well, you just got to do what you have to do when you have to do it. They add up one day at a time, 1 year at a time. I guess I could say I'm kind of proud of becoming a registered civil engineer with no education. I was able to pass the exam and became a civil engineer. So that was one of the things I kind of proud of. I feel an accomplishment that is almost impossible.
Yeah. I'm sure if somebody had come and told that kid in the cotton field in McFarland that he was going to do that and win all these sailing races, he would have thought you were a little nuts.
That's right. That's it.
Well, I'm going to give her a chance to tell me her secrets for 79 years of marriage. But let me give you the opportunity to talk about Ruth a little bit. After 79 years, I'm guessing you know her pretty well. And there are some things that maybe you appreciate about her. So what have you appreciated and loved about her all these years?
We've done the job we were supposed to do. You know, you get up there, you promise to do your duty to God and country and obey the Scout law. You're better or for worse, sickness and health, richer or poorer. So we've done it all. We've done our job.
Your turn. What's the secret of 79 years?
Accepting each other's faults.
You mean you have those?
I have them, yeah. Well, I think accepting each other's faults and make the best of it.
What have you appreciated about him?
Him taking good care of me, especially when I get sick. He's done a good job. I enjoyed the sailing most of all, and crewing on the boat and winning.
Did you really know what he was going to want to do before he told you?
No. But once we got in the boat, I knew what, in a tight race, I knew what to do. I just kept my mouth shut and worked.
He's trying to remember if you kept your mouth shut. He looks a little perplexed there. It's not how, is that not the way you remember it?
But that's about it. Yeah, that's, I have no comment to me.
And now we know how you've made it 79 years and counting. Lewis and Ruth Wagoner of Fresno, California. Find photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.